Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Sweet. So for Dear Science this week, we're starting off by talking about COVID-19. And yesterday marked the first day that we, a year since we went into the level 4 lockdown, which lasted for quite a while. And now people are getting vaccinated. And we're talking about whether COVID-19 has peaked. So has it?
That's a very good question. And as vaccination sort of programs are getting going around the world, you'd think maybe we'd see a change, and maybe we do, but it's probably too soon to be sure at this point. So on the 11th of January this year, there was a record. That was the peak. There was 740,000 new cases were reported globally on that day. 2 weeks later, there were 14,400 deaths in a single day, and those are the peak values that we've seen so far. And from that sort of climax, the numbers have fallen continuously until the 20th of February, when there was about 360,000 new cases, so a bit less than 50% of that peak, and fewer than 9,500 deaths. So the drop in cases and the drop in deaths come as the vaccination programs have been rolling out. As of about the 16th of March, nearly 90 million people have been fully vaccinated. So that's if they're on the two-dose vaccine, that's they've had both doses. And about 390 million doses had been administered. So that's a little over a week ago. And so you'd think, okay, well, the vaccine's coming. You know, people are beginning to get immunity, so you should see a drop in COVID. But there's quite a few uncertainties, and there is certainly fewer cases than we had at the peak, and there's certainly a drop because there are a large number of people have already been infected. So this is independent of the vaccine, and in dense urban settings like New York City or big cities in India and Mexico and other places, those places have already gone through the bulk of the epidemic, and there's such a large number of people who have already had COVID that there are fewer places for it to go. So there are certainly less COVID in those places, but global cases have already started to slightly rise again since February, and the daily number of new cases is hovering around about the 440,000 mark. So it's still a huge, huge problem, and it looks like it may be just edging up again. The researchers think the numbers are not ever going to likely hit they are unlikely to hit January's peak, but it's not clear whether they're just going to start dropping now as vaccinations, become more prevalent. Elsewhere in the world, populations have not reached the levels of natural immunity seen in places like the big cities around the world. So places like India's huge cities and New York City and other places, so there is still, you know, a lot of fertile ground, so to speak, for the virus to infect, and in places where there's relatively low prevalence of the virus, when we start mixing again, so New Zealand is a case here, when we start mixing again, when restrictions are relaxed, that could also cause a rise in cases. So people are, there's places in America already that are starting to open up, even though not all the population is vaccinated, and it's very likely that we will see a rise in cases. Certainly in Italy and some other countries in Europe, they're already considering tighter lockdowns as the numbers start creeping up again. There's a few other unknowns. So another unknown is how long immunity, either from the vaccine or from infection, actually lasts. So we don't know. I mean, the vaccine, they think they've got a fairly clear idea that the immunity should last, at least a large number of months. But from whether you've been infected, it's not clear whether you can be infected again, and how early you can be infected again. So that's going to affect whether we're going to see more outbreaks, and also these emerging variants of the virus. So there's the variant that started in the UK, and there's variants from Brazil and other places that seem to be more virulent, and they also seem to be, in some cases at least, resistant to the vaccine, which could also push things up. So fingers crossed we're at the peak or near the peak, but we'll see.
That's scary. It is a little scary knowing that we could still get the vaccine and there still could be a lot of threat coming in through the front door.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem. So New Zealand is, in so many ways, we're in a good situation. And the yesterday's anniversary certainly made that abundantly clear. You know, we are running around freely and a lot of the rest of the world isn't. But at some point, we've got to open up. And New Zealand is a little bit slower to get the vaccine out. And we don't have the bulk of cases of people who have had COVID that are sort of already immune. So the danger for New Zealand, certainly, and countries that have done well, is that we could see a spike when we actually do open up.
Okay, so moving on to our next topic for today, we're talking about helicopters on Mars. Do you want to go away with this, Anika?
I mean, that's quite exciting. NASA's first helicopter to fly over Mars. What does this mean for potential exploration of the planet?
Well, it's just really cool, isn't it? I mean, so we've got, this is the first, if successful, so this will be the first controlled powered flight on another planet. And the little craft, it's about, it's an $80 million small helicopter that's called Ingenuity. And it weighs about 1.8 kilos. Since they landed a few weeks ago, they've been looking around for a good sort of 10 meter square patch of ground that would make a good takeoff and landing spot. And it turned out that it was quite easily found where they were. And so what's happening now is that the rover is currently driving to the center of this airfield, this Mars airport that they've designated. And what's going to happen is it's going to take about 6 days. So this helicopter is sitting inside the belly of the rover, and it's going to take about 6 days for it to be sort of emerge. Bindings have to be broken, and it has to be rotated, and it has to be moved around. So its legs have to be extended and things like that. And then it gets put down onto the ground, and then Perseverance, the rover, has to drive away quite quickly because Ingenuity, the helicopter, can only last about one cold night on Mars before its solar panel can be exposed to sunlight. And so the rover has to get away quickly to allow that to happen. And what's going to happen is they'll try and drive to an overlook about 60 meters away and turn its cameras onto the helicopter. And the helicopter, in turn, will turn its cameras on the rover, and so they'll be looking at each other, which is just bizarre, just weird. And then they're going to spend a little bit of time commissioning the chopper. They're going to pull its blades out. It's got two counter-rotating, 1.2-meter blades. And if the weather is good, it will lift off. The rotors will spin at a little over 2,500 revolutions per minute. It will climb about 3 meters, turn around, and then slowly descend over about 30 seconds. So the first flight, very, very short, just up, turn around a bit, and then go down again. And that'll be sort of the historic moment. But then after that, they're scheduled to do 4 more flights, ranging over a flight zone about 60 meters long, reaching up to about 5 meters in altitude, taking lots of photos. And ultimately, if the helicopter can fly out and return, then they're going to try and do more and more ambitious things with it.
Yeah, we've got a question from a listener, which also was intriguing me. So how does helicopter work on Mars when there's no atmosphere?
Well, there is an atmosphere. It's a lot less, the atmospheric pressure is a lot less than Earth. I think it's only a fraction of a percent of Earth's atmospheric pressure. But they've figured out that these rotors are big enough and rotate fast enough and give it enough lift so that something that's about a kilo and a bit can fly.
Okay, so moving on to our final topic for today.
One more thing, because this is really cool. Because I read the article and this made me smile. Taped beneath the solar panel of the helicopter is a square of unbleached muslin, which is about the size of a postage stamp, and that was taken from the original Wright Flyer, the first powered aircraft to stay aloft on Earth.
Aww.
So I think
that's quite
cool.
Sweet. That's quite sentimental,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, that definitely is. So, okay, now moving on to our final topic for today. We're talking about species and how we can go out and find one for ourselves.
Yeah, so if you're a budding ecologist and you're interested in finding new species of various amphibians or lizards or birds, then there are places on this planet where there is a decent likelihood that there will be new species found if you look hard enough. So there's a chance. Researchers have created an interactive map, and I think you're going to put a link on the website, that shows diversity hotspots and places which have the richest potential for new mammal, bird, reptile, and amphibian species. So these are all vertebrates. And it lists for each region in the world, it lists, you know, what they calculate to be the chance of finding a new species. So there's certainly areas in, you know, darkest Peru that are, you know, dense jungle areas where there is a very reasonable likelihood of finding species. But they're also, you know, you look on the map and even, you know, the southwest of New Zealand, the South Island, there is some chance of finding certainly new, I think he said certainly new amphibian species. I'm not sure. So if you are the budding ecologist, then they've made it easier maybe for you to go out and find. So there are 32,000 known vertebrates, and these researchers used computer models to determine the probability of when an organism with different combinations of attributes could be discovered or where they would be discovered. And it tracks, so there's places like some places like the Guinean forests of West Africa, and many Southeast Asian islands are likely to be rich in undescribed organisms because they have very high densities of species and are also relatively inaccessible. So we haven't really been there very much. More than 10% of the world's undiscovered land vertebrates are in Brazil, and Madagascar, Colombia, and Indonesia account for 5% each. And so they're fertile ground for finding new species. So take a look at the website. The map makers, they say, are not done. They hope to develop similar maps that could help scientists find thousands of species of invertebrates and also plants.
Well, I think we should definitely try and find a vertebrate.
I mean, just a question. If you discover a new species, do you get naming rights?
I think you should. Oh. I don't know, but
we need a BFM
should.
Creature. That's what we need.
A little mascot. Perfect.
Yeah. Sweet. Well, that's all we've got for Dear Science this week. Thank you so much, Marcus.
You're very welcome.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Yeah, once again,